This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My next guest is the author Toya Wolf. Her debut novel, Last Summer on State Street, first came out in 2022. It's out now in paperback. It tells the story of four girls growing up in Chicago's Robert Taylor Homes. At the time, the city was tearing them down. The book has won a number of awards, Chicago Writers Association Book of the Year Award in Traditional Fiction, Friends of American Writers Adult Fiction Award, and it was even named to the quote-unquote underrated book club of pro basketballer Steph Curry. When I spoke with Wolf last summer, she was about to formally receive another award, this one the Pattis Family Foundation Chicago Book Award. I'm reading here from a news release announcing the selection. The award celebrates works that transform public understanding of Chicago, its history, and its people. We talk with her about all of that, her book, and her life as a writer. As a reminder, our program's on tape today, but we love hearing what you think about what we've talked about. So send an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address. talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now is my conversation with Toya Wolf, author of Last Summer on State Street. Toya Wolf, thank you so much for making the time to be with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I want to begin with the setting for your book, the Robert Taylor Homes.
Yeah.
For people who haven't read it, or maybe they didn't grow up in Chicagoland before the turn of the century, what were the Robert Taylor Homes?
They were a series of high-rise projects. So they were 16 stories tall, and there were 28 of them packed into 2 miles of land. That's a lot of numbers, I know. But so think 16 stories high and 28 of them sort of compacted in a row. And people have maybe heard of Cabrini Green or Henry Horner, and they were sort of in that same vein of housing built for like people who couldn't afford very, you know, expensive housing in the city of Chicago.
And these, you would see them driving up the Dan Ryan Expressway, Interstate 94, heading past Comiskey Park, and It strikes me there's a certain irony because, right, Robert Taylor was a banker and chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority. His father, also Robert Taylor, was the first accredited African-American architect. But the younger Taylor favored desegregating white Chicago neighborhoods and scattered site public housing. So there's the irony in these homes being named for him, the opposite of his ideas.
Yes.
I wonder, you grew up there yourself. What did you think about living there when you were a kid?
Well, when you're a kid, you don't have this sort of pull back idea of urban planning. And if your parents are doing a great job, you don't even realize you're poor for the longest time. So I think growing up, I had a group of friends. I loved school. I enjoyed sort of being in a community. And I think there were times when my life was interrupted by gunshots or gang activity or police sweeps and things like that. But growing up, I had like an incredibly happy childhood, like I did, and my friends. And so I just think that later I learned about so many policies and so many terrible things that were sort of put in place that set us up to sort of fail in this neighborhood. But while I was a child, I wasn't really aware of any of this. And I think people can drive past the buildings and they can kind of see the Robert Taylor Homes from the outside. But very often, the young people on the inside, there's a while before you realize like where you're actually living and what the conditions are actually like.
And what people think of it from the outside, right?
Because you live in a very sort of insulated neighborhood where people are like you, they look like you, they eat the same foods as we have some of the same activities. And so I think it's not until you go outside of your neighborhood that you start to see that you are othered and, you know, what people think about you. But I just think for a while, if you're lucky, you're not even aware of these attitudes.
Yeah. And I mean, as you say, the Robert Taylor Homes have this reputation nationally as, I guess, what would you say, a failed experiment in urban planning, right? A place of crime and gangs and drugs and many of the isms of our society. But one thing your book does is show it to also be a place of family and friendship and compassion and love. When did you come to understand that dichotomy?
I think definitely by the time I was in high school, when I was really thinking seriously about my future and if I would go to college and things like that, I think that's when it's it's hard to sort of deny that you're living in this very dangerous place and that you have a stigma because, you know, people stigmatize you because of where you're growing up. And so I think it definitely finds you. Like you have this season of innocence. And then, you know, the clock's only ticking. And I mean, it's this way for children anywhere, but I think when you're growing up in the Robert Taylor Homes or any other sort of housing project, there's only a matter of time before the sort of bubble is burst. And for some kids, it's a lot younger than others.
Hmm. So why did you choose to return there in your mind to set the book there?
Oh, I really didn't choose it. It chose me.
Say more about that.
So my writing program at Columbia College here in Chicago, it has an emphasis on seeing in the mind, sort of your... People talk about setting and place and plot and things like that, but I was in a writing program that really asked us to see our characters and like where they are and like really, you know, use the senses and, you know, put people in those places. And I had started writing about this group of girls and it became very clear to me that they were running around these buildings where I grew up. I was not very happy about that because in order to be a well-balanced adult, I had actually taken so much of like the negative stuff about the Robert Taylor Homes and stuffed it somewhere, you know? And now I'm sitting in these writing classes and all these things are sort of coming back to me, like the conditions of the stairwells and what it's like to hear gunshots and to have to stop what you're doing and fall onto the ground. Like I just, you can't walk around with these sorts of things and be a well-balanced human, you know? But here these characters sort of emerged and they were jumping rope where I used to jump rope and they were sort of running around this structure. And so eventually I gave into it and I just had to lean into what I was seeing.
All right. So you have these four little girls, Fifi, Precious, Stacia, and Tonya.
Yeah.
Tell us about them.
Yeah, they are an unlikely pairing. And the thing that brings them together is Double Dutch, because Double Dutch is, it's actually a very complicated rope game. There are other games where it just takes, you know, two people to turn the rope just in one direction and anyone can jump in. But Double Dutch uses two ropes and you have to have like a certain level of coordination to make sure the ropes are like turning the way they ought to. And then you have to actually jump in between these two ropes. You need at least three players to jump Double Dutch. And so these characters, the main character, Fifi, she has a friend, Precious, who she's known since she was born because their parents were sort of friends and knew each other. But then you have a character, Stacia, who, you know, her family, they're known for being sort of neighborhood bullies and their family actually runs the neighborhood gang. And it's very unusual for someone like her to be friends with Fifi and Precious. But Fifi invites her to join this little, her friendship duo. And then eventually they bring in Tonya, who has a very different upbringing. Her mom is, has a drug addiction. And so she's sort of like at the very bottom of the social ladder, even amongst kids. But the four of them form this unlikely friendship for a while. And this is sort of who we follow. Precious, who comes from a very religious family and spends all week in church, and Tonya, who has this very nomadic kind of life. And then Stacia, who for all intents and purposes is sort of hood royalty. So these are the four girls that we meet and sort of go on a journey with.
Yeah. And Fifi, I've seen you describe her as the kid who you have to remind that they're not an adult, that
yes.
they have to look out for everyone else. So they're so different. And at that age, you know, they're different at that age. And I think that we as readers see they have different possibilities for their futures too, right? And probably they themselves are imagining what their possibilities are. What brings them together?
Yeah, I think, I actually think it's Fifi who is the sort of person who has compassion for people. And I think Fifi invites Stacia and Tonya into the fold for the very same reason. Like she recognizes that these two girls don't have community and she wants to kind of share this privilege that she has. And so when she does invite Stacia to come and be friends. And I'm trying to remember, I'm working on a TV adaptation of this book, and it's sort of set a year before the book. So I'm trying to make sure that, like, I'm actually talking about the what's in the novel. But
sure.
Because you don't actually, I don't think it's sort of characterized in the book, like how Stacia joins Fifi and Precious, but it's she sort of invites Stacia in to be friends with them, even though it's very dangerous and Precious is not sure about this, you know, but she does the same thing with Tanya. And so they're friends because Fifi is the kind of person who wants to be inclusive, and she feels like they can kind of work it out. They will figure out some way to get along. And so that's how these four girls become, you know, a little group for a time.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with the author Toya Wolf, whose debut novel is Last Summer on State Street. It's out now in paperback. You open the book with a metaphor of a playground game, not Double Dutch. I understand it's a little different, which is All In Together. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so All In Together is, it's the most inclusive rope game you could ever play, because you can fit about 8 or 9 people. It's the same rope you use to jump Double Dutch. So if it's just sort of not doubled up, you can get a bunch of people in the rope. And if you even see All In Together from across the street, then you know you can run across the street and jump in the rope. It just very much is like, it's called All In Together, and it really is just like everyone just come and join. And it is a metaphor for the novel itself, because for a time, it's like Fifi is saying, everyone come, like, let's be in community together. And then All In Together, there's the part in the song where you have to jump out of the rope. And this is a book about a community that starts off together, and then they sort of fall apart, and not in any sort of order, in no organized way. Like, people have to move. There's some violence that ensues, and you lose people. And so All In Together is such a great visual of what actually happens in the novel.
And this is because the Robert Taylor homes in the summer of 1999 are in the process of being deconstructed and the residents sent every which way.
Yeah, but also just the crime and the kind of lifestyle that some of the characters are living, where it's like, if you don't make some changes soon, you're going to end up, you know, in the grave or in jail. And that's just kind of, that's an understood rule of the sort of criminal life that some people are living. And then also just when you live in a violent neighborhood, things happen to people who aren't even affiliated with criminal activity. So it's just, it's not even, there is a relocation happening from the Chicago Housing Authority, but it's also just kind of this fateful summer when all four of these girls, their lives are changed, and they sort of, their innocence is sort of ended in this very specific summer.
And I don't know how much you want to talk about how the story develops. We should probably leave a fair amount of that for readers to discover, but you know, in the spirit of transforming public understanding, there is a key day in the second half of the book. Fifi, your narrator, notes the scent of death wafting on the summer breeze. And she goes on, she says, "The other thing that made the day notable was the absence of its usual suspects. From the very start of the day, you couldn't find anyone outside. This is how the neighborhood would look as we approached fall, with my building hemorrhaging families. But that day, I knew that the building was full, that everyone had chosen a hiding place and crouched there." And I get the sense there's a lot of capital T truth in that passage. Can you talk about that feeling?
I mean, there's so much going on there. Like, if you grew up in Chicago, no matter where you are, like right now in the state, if you grew up in Chicago, you actually may remember times in the summer when you get a like waft of this, there's this scent. It is like, it is horrible. And there's all this like myth about what you're actually smelling. Like, is it, you know, is it from way back in the day, the stockyards, and what's in the Chicago River from those days? Like, it just, I to this day cannot nail down what that scent is. And I just decided to put it in the book because there's so much like Chicago history that I kind of dumped in the book just because I could. This is the fun of being a fiction writer, you know? Mm-hmm. And, but just in this sort of foreshadowing, I thought I would use it as just a day when things were kind of strange. It smelled strange outside. The behavior of the residents was sort of strange. And that's one of the ways you stay safe in a neighborhood like this. Like, if anything looks unusual, you need to take it as a warning, even if you don't have, even if you don't have like evidence that something's going on. If people are not where they typically are, you need to go home. So this is
somebody knows something. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, this was one of those days. And so I just kind of like, I sort of poured everything into like this one day, and, you know, having so many things just be very kind of out of character.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more from my conversation with Toya Wolf, author of the novel Last Summer on State Street, winner of all sorts of awards from the Chicago Writers Association Book of the Year Award in Traditional Fiction, Friends of American Writers Adult Fiction Award. When we talk with her last year, she was about to receive the Pattis Family Foundation Chicago Book Award. We're not taking calls during our show today, but we do appreciate hearing what you think about it. So leave a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my conversation with the author Toya Wolf, who wrote the novel Last Summer on State Street. When I spoke with her last summer, she was about to receive the Pattis Family Foundation Chicago Book Award in an event outside the Newberry Library in Bughouse Square. The award celebrates works that transform public understanding of Chicago, its history, and its people, and you'll hear us talk about that some as we go on. Let's pick up where we left off. Toya Wolf, I want to talk about your sort of development as a writer. When is the first time in your life that you sort of knew you could write?
So I started writing when I was 10. I wrote this essay that won an award at school. And afterwards, I sort of leaned into poetry. But I think I didn't start writing seriously until in college, freshman year of college. I was at North Park University, and I wrote a short story. And it actually was the first time I played around with Fifi's voice. I didn't use any of, I probably should find that story, but I didn't use it in the book. But Fifi was writing a letter to the character who would become Stacia. And I just realized, like, I don't think it was a great story structurally, but I think it's the first time I started to really play around with voice. And I really, I transferred from North Park because I really wanted to study writing. And when you are in college, you can be an English major, but there typically are only about one or two creative writing, like fiction classes you can take. And Columbia College had 55 different writing classes, because it's an art school. And so I actually transferred schools so that I could like learn how to write seriously. So I think that's when I started to take it. It wasn't just sort of a thing I could do and like a hobby. So that's sort of when I started.
Did you feel encouraged along the way through your education?
I did because I won a short story contest. I won second place, but it still had like a monetary, you know, there was like some money attached to it. Mm-hmm. And again, it was like, it's sort of the nucleus of what became this book. It was called Tanya from the 10, and it was a story about Tanya. And I think from that point on, I was really affirmed that like, I should stick with these girls and that I'm becoming a better writer because here is this contest and they could have chosen anyone. And I was one of the people that they chose.
So you've been living with these characters a long time now.
Very long time. And I didn't, I think about a character like Precious who wasn't very religious until like maybe the last few years. Her character changed over the years. She used to be a very sort of like whiny, spoiled brat kind of character. But then I realized if I made her the polar opposite, she was more wise, that I could really leverage that amongst these four girls. So I've known them for a long time, but I've been tweaking their character for a long time. Stacia, I remember the day I gave Stacia like 11 siblings. And then the next day going, what did you do? You have to give them all names and give them all like story. Like you have to build a character for all these people you've just, you know, put in this apartment. And so, yeah, I think I created them a long time ago, but they've just really started to put on their final touches in the last few years.
So I've heard a number of great writers say you have to read before you can write. So what what writers did you most admire? What did you read? Where did you learn to write through reading?
You know, when I was very young, I mean like 8, 9, 10, I had teachers put like Edgar Allan Poe and like poets like Coolidge in my hands. Like they're just old white dudes, right? But I don't know. I think it really, it started this curiosity for like what else was out there. And then I went from reading that stuff to reading like John Grisham novels and Stephen King, like things you can get your hands on at a thrift store. And then when I got to college, I took a class called Black Women Writers. And I think that's when it clicked for me that Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and Toni Katie Bambara, they were writing about their experiences as Black women living in a small town or in a city. And it just made me ask the question, what am I going to contribute to this canon of Black women writers? Like what's missing? And I just thought to myself, no one's writing about, there isn't a novelist writing about Black women in Chicago. And I think that's going to be something different that I can contribute.
Yeah. You open with a quote from Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can talk about what that means to you.
You know, she was the first, I won't say the first, but Their Eyes Were Watching God is a book about community. And it doesn't always show community in the best light. And I thought it was like an authentic expression of how the community could have your back or the community could be like poison. And I think her book shows you both. And you'll see in Last Summer on State Street that the community sometimes acts like a chorus. Sometimes it's very fractured, but sometimes it's like this big body, like a mob or a big community to kind of embrace the kids. And so Zora Neale Hurston is one of the Black women who I read early on and thought, wow, like she is doing an incredible job of laying out her community. And I know it's not like autobiographical, but I think it's nearly impossible as a writer to not sort of drag some of your experiences into your work. And so, yeah, so I think she's kind of one of the first to do it. And so I wanted to honor her in that way.
So with this Pattis Book Award, I keep coming back to this phrase, transforming public understanding of Chicago, its history, and its people.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems like awesome recognition. I think a lot of us who are professional communicators, writers, journalists, we strive to transform public understanding. But
yeah.
You know, actually hitting the mark and being recognized for it, that seems like a different thing. And yet,
I can imagine it brings a certain amount of pressure too. How are you thinking about becoming a literary voice of Chicago?
First of all, it is quite the honor that I could even be sort of on the list of the kind of people who could have won this award. And I think I've had to work under pressure for most of my life, and I think it's served me well for this moment. I think it is, even going back to the writer's desk to work on book two, I think you have to, a good amount of pressure is, it's good for you, you know? But I had to ask myself this question of like, okay, you've written a book and it has won several awards, which is, no one expects this, like, especially for their first book, no one. So I go back to a desk to start an ill-formed second book that's in first draft state, you know, and I just have to come humbly to the computer, like, this is going to be trash for a while. And that's okay. That's okay. So much, if you create any sort of art, you have to understand that when you get started, things don't make much sense and they don't look very good. And so I just think, I'm going to always write about Chicago. I'm going to always write about Black women. And I just think it takes as long as it takes. And I think going back to writing another book, having all of this sort of affirmation, I see it as fuel to keep going and not just like, you know, you're in the spotlight now, go do great things. Like, I take all of this love and I'm going to use it as fuel to just to keep going.
Well, you've sort of answered one of my questions I was curious about, which is, you've been with these characters for so long. Is your next book staying in this universe, or, you know, Cold War spy novel, Western? Where do you go from here?
Well, Brian, I definitely could stay in this story world, but I'm going to take a break for my mental health. Because there's some, as even though it's fiction, it's a tough world to navigate, even as the writer, you know.
Yeah.
But I know that I will return to it in novel form, because, you know, this will be part of a series, but I'm just not, I want to take a little break and write something different. But I am actually polishing a TV adaptation of the book. So I would love to continue forming these characters, but in sort of script format. And then when I'm ready in a few years, we'll return to State Street. And
I would say, I don't know how much you can say about the TV project. How did that come about? Where will we be able to look for it?
Well, we are in, it's not actually sold. I just wrote the script.
Okay.
I just adapted it. And then I've had some phone calls, I got to meet some really great people in Hollywood, and just sort of after a conversation, it wasn't exactly what they were looking to buy right now, but just the conversations themselves, again, like, really encouraged me to keep going, because these people were talking to me like I've been writing scripts my whole life, and I know they don't have to do that. Like, they don't have the time to just, like, sort of lift up people who aren't sort of talented in that way. And so I think we will find the right team of people to help make this show when the time is right. Mm-hmm. But I'm really interested in writing for TV because I'm a very extroverted novelist, which sounds like an oxymoron, but we exist, we're out here. And I would love to write for TV because you really get to sit around a table with several writers and talk out story and collaborate and do it together. And that just sounds like a dream to me. Mm. So I'm working on another novel, but I'm also working on two other TV pilots. And so, we will definitely return to State Street, but my next book, will be in Chicago, and I'll get to sort of spotlight a handful of Chicago neighborhoods and some, you know, some suburbs, some close by friends of the city, like Oak Park. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it will be a little different, but I think you'll still hear that Toya Wolf voice.
Yeah. So we're coming to the end of our time together. I know you've done a lot of interviews and events to talk about this book in the last year plus. I wonder what reaction you've gotten that's most surprised you.
I was surprised by how many people resonate with this story, and they don't even live the life of city folks. Like, I have a friend whose mom grew up on a farm, and the nearest person who could jump rope with her was 2 miles away. And she didn't grow up with like girlfriends that she could just go knock on their door and say, let's come outside and play. But there's still something about the connection of childhood and girlhood that she could resonate with. And she grew up on a farm in Wisconsin. And the book has been issued in the UK. And I went to London to do a panel on girlhood and to do some radio promo over there at like the BBC and stuff. And it just like, now we're on the other side of the world and people like were connecting with the story about these girls growing up in this housing project in Chicago in this very specific neighborhood for Black people. So I'm just, you know, you hear all the time, the more specific a thing, the more universal it is. And it just sounds like, you know, it sounds like it's not true, but this is like proof. If you really just tell a story that you know, about a world that you know, and you really just sort of zone in on your experience and how you saw the people moving around in the space, you'd be really surprised at how many people can relate to it. So that's been the biggest shocker.
Well, Toya Wolf, congratulations on the award. Congratulations on the book. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you. It's been great.
Toya Wolf is the author of Last Summer on State Street, out now in paperback. That's it for us today. Before we go, I do want to suggest joining our texting group. We ask questions about what we're talking about on the show. We love sharing your thoughts and comments on air. You can join by sending the word talk to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word talk, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. You can find more about that and every other way to contact us at our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can also find links to subscribe to our podcast or just look us up on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Damian Contreras is our digital producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.